Israel was not able to dictate its preferences. So Palestine's flag was raised and the Palestinian anthem was played when the Palestinian team marched out on the grounds. This is considered an achievement for us.
Having Palestine's flag raised in the Asian Championships for the first time was a huge achievement. However, raising our flag in Australia is our biggest achievement, especially as we know Australia voted against Palestine 2 weeks before at the UN Assembly. Our nation has the right to have a state and live in peace. We deserve to live. Today we are among 16 Asian countries. Although our country is under siege and the most basic necessities do not exist, our national team is here today, among the teams of great countries like Japan, Iran, Australia, Korea, and others. When hearing the national anthem here in this stadium with the players and technical team, in which I'm a member, with the rest of the Arab, Palestinian, and Asian audience which supported our team to the finals, it gives you an indescribable feeling. This feeling comes because you're one of the soldiers who participated in raising the flag of your country in the international arena.
The Palestinian team qualified to the finals in the Asian Cup for the first time in history. The Asian Cup started in the 1960s. The Israeli occupation used to participate among other countries under the name of the State of Israel, as if Palestine did not exist. In 1970, a group of noble and honest Arabs expelled Israel from the Asian Football Confederation and replaced them with Palestine as a member. We regained our right to membership of the International Football Federation, in which we can participate in the World Cup. The occupation knows that sports creates a good image toward the Palestinian people, so it wants to sabotage it, destroy it, and hide it from the world. It wants to present the Palestinians to the world as terrorists.
For every athlete in Palestine, there is a sad tale of suppressed opportunity under the Israeli occupation, which deliberately puts obstacles before the Palestinian sporting industry to keep it behind closed doors.
One of the circumstances that helped me play football was living near Rafah Services Club and the UNRWA Club. I was able to get into the national junior team, the national youth team, then the Olympic team, and finally the national team. I received the best junior player title in the Palestinian League for the year 2005 to 2006. On July the 22nd, 2009, I was supposed to travel to the West Bank to join Balata Youth Center Club as a professional player at the boot camp of the national team in Al Farah. However, some other players and I were stopped and I was arrested. I was the only one among them to be arrested and without reason.
I was assigned to form the Palestinian Federation for Self-Defense Games, sponsored by the Paralympics Committee. This committee is specialized in training special needs athletes in order that they may participate in international championships and the Olympics. We received an invitation from the MRT Ahli Club to participate in the Dubai International Championship of 2016. We participated with a team of six players, one able female, an able male, and four visually impaired athletes. Our team competed strongly in this championship, and for the first time in Arab and Palestinian team, won third position and received a bronze medal. It feels great to raise the Palestinian flag and play the Palestine national anthem at such a championship. Upon our team's return back home, I was arrested by the Israeli police and detained for 5 hours, and the blind players were also held. My team insisted on not leaving without me. How could they leave when they have no one to guide them back home?
It's no coincidence that the arrest of Palestinian athletes has pushed a number of prisoners from the sports sector to more than 70. This number refers to the expansion of deliberate targeting of promising sports champions by the occupation.
I was detained without charge for no other reason than for being a Palestinian athlete representing my country. I spent 3 years in the Israeli prisons. During my sentence period, I was interrogated from time to time and manipulated to try to make me confess to anything. But in the end, they had to let me go. It shows to what extent the Israeli intelligence had nothing on me. They wanted to prove that they did not just arrest a Palestinian athlete, but a terrorist from their view. They could not prove anything, so they released me after 3 years. I was released, but with many health problems, because I had gone on a hunger strike for 96 days. These problems prevented me from continuing my football career. I do not wish for any athlete to experience the same situation I faced. ما بتمنى انه اي لاعب يتعرض للموقف اللي تعرضت له
وكان هو من المفروض ان يكون مؤتمر صحفي على حاجز معبر Upon our arrival to the Erez Beit Hanun checkpoint, we were supposed to have a press conference with a number of international journals and agencies. But to our surprise, I was arrested and the blind boys were held and pushed outside. I was held for 26 days in the interrogation cells at Ashkelon prison. They accused me of training terrorists. I responded, if you say that these blind boys are terrorists, I wonder how you can call them terrorists. It was bizarre that the interrogator was watching some reports on YouTube about the team, and he knew that I was training these blind boys. They presented me with a number of trials, 5 trials consecutively. Each trial extended my arrest period. I was released after the last trial, innocent of all charges. I believe that the whole thing was for the purpose of disruption and killing of our happiness, so that the people in Gaza would not feel the joy of our success.
The case of Hassan al-Rai is not the first one. We have more than 70 to 80 cases like his. There is the case of Sami Ad-Daur, who was arrested simply for being a national team player, along with Fadi al-Sharif. Ayman al-Nafadi received a medical transfer to have a crucial ligament operation. After his operation, he returned back to Gaza and was immediately arrested with his fresh injury. Beit Hanun Eretz checkpoint has become a daily arrest and interrogation point. Its purpose is to insult people. How could a country that presents itself as being a democratic state grant an entrance visa to someone and then arrest them?
Israeli violations were not limited to false arrests. They adhered to discriminatory policies of not issuing travel permits for players to participate in both domestic and international championships.
Athletics games are competitive. It requires capabilities. To become international, you need tremendous capabilities. It requires the potentials of countries, not individuals. Because of the siege on our country and the closure of the Rafah border crossing for the past 2 years now, Palestinian runner Inas was not able to travel to participate in a championship in the UAE. She was not given a pass to travel across Eretz Point. Furthermore, she was supposed to participate in the Beit Lehem 10-kilometer marathon, but she did not get a checkpoint pass for that either.
We exercised hard to have our names included in the Bethlehem Championship, but because of not receiving a checkpoint pass, I was deprived from participating. I trained intensely for the 10-kilometer race for 2 months prior to the race, even though I knew I had no permission to pass. We practiced hard, and I think maybe we could have won first place in that competition.
As a trainer for the national team, I suffered a lot moving between the governorates to reach Ramallah to be with the Palestine national team. It was hard for the players I chose from the clubs in Gaza to reach the northern governorates, which affected the competitive level of the national team. It is hugely suffering for the athletes inside Palestine.
We could not get the majority of our players to the northern governorates because of the delay in getting checkpoint passes. On one hand, because these games have specific dates, and on the other hand, the permissions to pass were either denied or given after the expiration of the specific date of the games, so Gazan athletes did not participate in these games.
Palestine participated in the 2010 World Cup playoffs. According to the draw, we were supposed to face the team of Malaysia. As we do not have a home ground, we used to play our games outside Palestine. We were matched up with Malaysia in an away game. We were supposed to meet the team in Malaysia. But 3 days before the match, the Israeli occupation prevented the Palestinian team from leaving. This injustice was not confined to the Israeli occupation. FIFA too was unjust towards us when it issued a statement in which the Palestinian team was condemned for not participating.
Practically every country in the world has a unified football league, with the exception of Palestine, which is forcibly deprived of that right. So the Palestinian Football Union seeks to at least unite the West Bank and Gaza Strip leagues to try to address Israeli measures that impose separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The occupation is what divides the Palestinian territories into smaller parts. I'm referring to the 1948 Palestinian territories. There are the northern governorates of the West Bank and the southern governorates of the Gaza Strip. We try as much as possible to unite these communities by holding local competitions with the Palestinian clubs in the governorates of our land.
We have a diaspora league, the West Bank League, and the Gaza League. The teams in Gaza are not permitted to meet the teams of the West Bank, nor the diaspora. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid can move throughout Spain, but in Gaza, its teams play only each other, and the teams within the West Bank play each other. So there is one champion in Gaza and one champion in the West Bank. We've been appealing to the world to pressure the occupation to allow our teams access across checkpoints. This appeal is 20 years old now. We've had 20 years of league championships in Gaza, which have all been kept separate from the West Bank championships.
When the Palestinian National Authority took over, there were many attempts to have one unified league between the West Bank and Gaza. However, the obstacle of not having to pass the district prevented players from coming together. This also resulted in poor communications between the athletes and teams from each area, so we had to come up with the compromise of having two leagues. One league includes the clubs of Gaza, the other includes the clubs of the West Bank. I hope one day the winners of the two districts can play each other.
For a quarter of a century, we've appealed, and I myself appealed to football officials associated with FIFA, which is to have one unified Palestinian league. We want a league similar to that of the USA, Russia, Britain, Spain, France, Germany, and all countries around the world. We want to establish a unified league that unites the West Bank and Gaza, but Israel stands against this.
Setting a precedent, the Palestinian Football Union, in 2015, held a match between trophy champions of the West Bank and Gaza, despite all that was done by the occupation to prevent any such meeting.
In 2015, the winners of the Cup of Gaza, for the first time in 15 years, met up with the winners of the West Bank Cup. They met despite the will of the occupation because of the intervention of FIFA. The away game was held in Gaza, while the home game was held in the West Bank, and then we pronounced the outright winner.
The union decided to hold a match between the champions of the northern governorates and southern governorates so as to decide a unified champion that would represent Palestine in the Asian Games. The match was between the Shujaya Union Club representing Gaza governorates and Al Khalil Ahli Club representing the West Bank. The Al Khalil Ahli Club won the championship.
We were excited, but Israel obstructed the event by arresting a number of players, and the Shabak Israeli Security Agency interrogated them for several hours. In addition to this, many players were refused a checkpoint pass. If it was not for the interference of FIFA and other countries, this sporting event would have not been held.
The escalation of violations by the occupying forces against Palestinian sports and athletes did not stop at international norms. Its momentum increased in the wars waged by the occupation on Gaza, the most violent of which occurred in the summer of 2014.
Palestine Stadium was shelled with a dozen bombs, each weighing about a ton. The stadium was completely destroyed. Not only the stands, but the whole field was unplayable. The Rafah Municipal Stadium was also shelled in 2008. This city has champion teams, but we've been unable to rebuild the stadium until now. Till now, I find it difficult as an athlete, a Palestinian, or even a follower of sports and current affairs to understand why the occupation would bombard playgrounds and sports clubs. We don't know the reason except to think that the occupation does not want to see any young Palestinian, especially athletes, to achieve greatness in sport or for them to play other Arab teams or internationally.
Rafah Stadium was one of the targets of Israel's military complex. We don't know why. It is just a stadium like any other around the world. Palestinian youth play in this stadium. It was, however, shelled with more than just one bomb by an F-16 warplane. The building and the grounds were completely destroyed. Now it is a playground without any stands. Of course, the field is not suitable to play on, but it is the only one that exists. Fragments of steel and rock can be still seen there. Many players stayed away from the stadium because of the bombardment.
Clubs were bombed, centers were bombed. More than 30 sports locations were bombed during the aggression on Gaza. There are no more than 5 stadiums, so the agenda of the General Federation of Football was affected dramatically. The capacity of other stadiums is limited, so by shelling these stadiums, from the Israeli perspective, it totally disrupts Palestinian sports.
The recent war on Gaza by the occupation's military exceeded every human standard and killed more than 27 Palestinian athletes. They joined the long list of victims who were athletes and martyred.
In the past 20 years, 400 or so Palestinian athletes have been martyred. These athletes are from all kinds of sporting backgrounds: football, volleyball, handball, and individual sports like martial arts. All of these sports lost memorable players. More than 400 Palestinian martyrs sacrificed their lives for the cause of Palestine. The Palestinian athlete is a Palestinian citizen before he or she is an athlete.
Israel deliberately targeted the sports sector as it did other sectors, such as health, social, and economics. We in the sports sector have 400 martyrs. At the top is Captain Ahad Zakout, who is one of our trainers. Many young players also were assassinated in the southern governorates. We as sports people are supposed to have immunity under international law to travel and participate, but Israel flouts these laws and international regulations.
On the morning of July 30, 2014, one Israeli war jet targeted a residential apartment with a rocket. The apartment was owned by the late athlete Ahed Zakout in the Al Nasser neighborhood in Gaza City, bringing an end to the life of an athlete who continues to inspire many even after his death.
I woke up to the voice of my mother screaming my name and my father's name, Khaled and Ahad. I went out and answered, "Here I am." She asked me where my father was. I say, "I don't know. I will look for him." She ran out of the house screaming for someone to help. The living room was on fire. A missile had hit the house, smashing walls and room and setting the living room on fire. My uncle was the first to enter our house.
I turned around and came into the house. The bedroom door was broken, blocking the entrance. I kicked it with my leg and was surprised to see Ahad lying under the separating wall between the bedroom and the living room. He was still breathing. His son then entered and started screaming.
We told him to bear witness that there is no God, but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. In his last moments, he was opening his mouth and closing it. Then the ambulance came and took him to the hospital, but he was later taken to the cemetery.
Captain Ahad Zaqt was the star player of the Palestinian National Football League. He was the star of Gaza Sports Club and played in many clubs inside Palestine. Then he became a trainer after retiring as a football player. He focused on the youth. Captain Ahad Zaqt wanted Palestine to have a promising future. He focused on having a national Palestinian team that would qualify for the finals of the World Cup in 10 years' time. But it seems this dream did not appeal to Israel. The Israeli occupation focuses on how to hit us at the core.
Despite all the crimes committed by the occupation against Palestinian sports and athletes, they would not be able to achieve their aims to undermine the resolve of the aspiring athletes who hope to represent Palestine at international tournaments and to hold high the Palestinian flag in states that have ignored and still ignore Palestinian rights.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha states, "Start doing good deeds at the moment since all of them are being recorded and the doors of the mercy of Allah are always open." This means that every person is welcome to enter to the spiritual realm. Now, there are some obstacles and hardships in our lives. These difficulties make us closer to Allah because we understand that the only way to reach to happiness is through worshipping Him. Now, in the past, there were some tight lanes in the cities of Iran which were called friendship lane. If two persons or neighbors had a fight or quarrel, they could talk over it in this lane. These lanes were so tight that the people couldn't pass each other without taking a look at each other. Now, the tightness of the alley is very much like the difficult situations we are in. Whenever we find an obstacle on our way, we want to reconcile Allah. The main reason is because it is only through Allah that we can solve our problems. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ranjbah. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Recently, several financial institutions and investment banking companies have warned of a recession looming over Britain as a result of surging inflation and worsening cost of living crisis that has hit Britons hard in recent months. The UK is facing with skyrocketing inflation, which has been unprecedented for decades, prompting thousands of British people in different industries to strike over payments. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. The website of Politico reports the UK government's fiscal watchdog has warned Britain faces the biggest fall in living standards on record during a 15-month recession fueled by soaring inflation, borrowing costs, and energy bills. A doom-laden briefing by the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, predicted average living standards for UK citizens will fall 7% over the two financial years to 2023 to 2024, wiping out the previous 8 years' growth. The OBR said this represented the biggest fall in living standards since comparable records began in 1956, and only the third time since that rate that living standards would fall in two consecutive years. The bleak forecasts were published on Thursday, November 17th, alongside a £55 billion package of planned tax rises and public spending cuts drawn up by UK Chancellor of Exchequer Jeremy Hunt in a bid to purportedly reassure markets that his government is committed to balancing the books. A senior UK government official stressed that the country had been heavily impacted by external factors, citing the COVID-19 pandemic and rising energy costs, and insisted the government would always protect the vulnerable. The opposition Labour Party pinned the blame on ministers after months of shifting economic policy. Hunt, installed as Chancellor recently in the wake of former Prime Minister Liz Truss' debt-funded mini-budget that rocked market confidence and saw borrowing costs soar, confirmed the UK economy is already in recession and set to shrink by a further 1.4% next year. In a sign of the challenge facing the new Chancellor, Hunt confirmed that UK borrowing is now projected to hit £177 billion this year, up sharply from £99 billion projection for 2022 to 2023 given by the OBR only back in March. The plan outlined by Hunt also sets up a massive political fight going into next election, currently due in 2024. In a sharp contrast to his predecessor Kwasi Kwarteng, who unveiled debt-funded tax cuts for Britain's top earners, the Chancellor is planning to reduce the salary threshold at which people start paying the country's top rate of income tax from £150,000 down to £125,000. Tax allowances and other income tax thresholds will be frozen up to 2028, meaning more people will be dragged into higher tax brackets. However, while Hunt's tax changes will kick in from next year, there was scant detail on where actual cuts to public services could be made. Treasury officials confirmed this would not be spelled out until the next wholesale review of departmental budgets, again due in 2024. Meanwhile, The Guardian Daily writes UK Chancellor Jeremy Hunt warned of a tough road ahead after Britain's economy shrank in the 3 months to September in what is expected to be the beginning of a lengthy recession. In his first estimate of growth in the third quarter, the Office for National Statistics, ONS, presented a bleak picture of the economy before next week's autumn statement from the Chancellor. Gross domestic product fell by 0.2% in the third quarter as households and businesses struggled with soaring inflation, while there was also a hit to activity as businesses closed for extra bank holiday for the funeral of Queen Elizabeth. The Bank of England expects the latest GDP figures to be the start of a prolonged UK recession, as rising interest rates and the cost of living take their toll on activity lasting until the end of next year. Another negative growth figure for the final 3 months of 2022 would confirm a technical recession. The economy grew by 0.2% in the second quarter of 2022. Hunt said the world economy was facing a period of extreme turbulence, but claimed that the fundamental resilience of the British economy is cause for optimism in the long term. He added, "I am under no illusion that there is a tough road ahead, one which will require extremely difficult decisions to restore confidence and economic stability. But to achieve long-term sustainable growth, we need to grip inflation, balance the books, and get debt falling. There is no other way." activity in the service sector ground to a halt, with zero growth over the quarter, driven by a fall in consumer spending as households came under mounting pressure from the cost of living crisis. Growth in the construction sector slowed while factory output slumped because of a sharp decline in manufacturing, as some businesses continued to struggle with supply chain difficulties and shortages of key materials. The economy shrank by 0.6% in September alone as shops and other businesses closed their doors, with about half of the fall attributed to the mourning period, with the widespread shutdown leading to a sharper decline than usual for a bank holiday. Alpesh Palija, the lead economist at the Federation of British Industry Lobby Group, said that even accounting for the extra bank holiday, it was clear that underlying activity had weakened. However, he warned the Chancellor against launching an austerity drive that would choke off growth further. The Independent Daily reports new polling reveals more than half of Britons blame the Conservative government over global factors for the cost of living crisis. A nationally representative poll of more than 2,000 people from Find Out Now for Channel 4 News found that 51% of people believe the government was largely culpable for the soaring cost of household bills, while 37% hold international factors such as the COVID-19 pandemic and conflict in Ukraine responsible. In the wake of Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's explosive autumn budget, 29% of voters said they now trust Labour to run the economy. Meanwhile, just 19% put their faith in the Conservative Party on fiscal matters. It comes after Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and his chancellor were charged with shielding the super-rich from paying their fair share of tax by refusing to abolish the non-dom loophole. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer charged the government with having gone after working people with tax hikes while doing nothing about non-dom status. Telling broadcasters during a visit to Swindon, the super rich are not paying their taxes in this country. Also, responding for Labour, Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves said, "The Conservatives have crashed our economy, given up on growth, and sent inflation through the roof. As usual, it is ordinary working people who are paying the price."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. we're going to talk about some of the laws or religious laws related to business according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the business-related religious laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law on the job which is exercised by a police person or a traffic officer? Or the employees of, customs department or the tax department in the Islamic Republic of Iran or in any other country?
Sure.
Are they the ones referred to in some of the ahadith that no supplication would be answered or granted by God if it, came from a sergeant or a tax collector?
Well, that's, misconception on the part of those people who raise these questions. According to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, there's no objection to their work, the work of a policeman, the work of a traffic police officer or employees working for the customs department. Of course, there's no objection working in such departments or such places, provided that they do their jobs according to Islamic standards, they carry out their duties in compliance with the laws and the regulation, and they fulfill their duties as they are required to do, and Giving the example of a tax collector, you know, mentioned in the hadith, of course, they are the ones who collect tax from for the non-Muslim countries, for the tyrannical governments,
mm-hmm.
not the ones who are working for an Islamic country and for Islamic system. They are doing their duties according to Islamic law and according to Sharia law. They are not to blame, okay? But a tax collector who collects tax from poor Muslims, from poor people, ordinary laity, in order to help a tyrannical government, that's the one included in the hadith
mm-hmm.
whose supplication is not answered.
I see. Okay, another question, Sheikh Sawid, let me ask you this. Some women work in beauty shops to, you know, earn a living for themselves or for their family. And does this not lead to immorality, which in turn is bound to undermine, or destroy the chastity of the Islamic society?
Again, this is to be said, I have to say that it's again a kind of deviating question. There is a need for a beauty parlor, for hairdressers, and for such places, for these salons, you know. There's no objection to working in beautifying women, and there's no objection to getting paid for using adornments, for making, for beautifying women, you know, provided that wearing the makeup is not intended for showing it to non-mahram men, because we know very well that a woman is not allowed to show her ornaments, her beautification, her makeup to non-mahram men. And therefore, if a woman beautifies herself for her husband or for someone who is halal to her, she's not to blame. And of course, if she herself cannot use makeup or wear makeup wear the adornments, she can go to a beauty parlor or a beauty salon where she can beautify herself and then make herself presentable, make herself beautiful and attractive, not for a non-mahram, but for a mahram like her husband.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Sawid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. So don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Sawid, our guest speaker. The subject we are still dealing with is business and religious laws about it, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh Sawid, is it permissible for an intermediary or a facilitator, a dealer sort of a work between the builders and the owners to get paid for their services?
Well, Ayatollah Khamenei says that there's no problem in getting paid for halal work, something which is basically halal, and there is the consent of both the builders and the owners of the building. There is no problem to get paid for the job he does. And, of course, the money he receives from either party, either the builder or the owners, is halal.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, and how about the commission, which is usually paid, as a money to an estate agent? Is it halal? Is this commission halal?
To be brief and to put it in a nutshell, I would like to say that according to His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no problem in that and also getting paid for that, provided that he gets paid for halal work, which is done at somebody's request, you know. Mm-hmm. If someone requests someone else, that agent or that individual who takes the commission for the job he does, of course the commission is halal, and there's no objection to him getting that money from the person who requested him.
How about the ruling on mutual or one-sided contracts carried out over the phone?
Well, contracts carried out over the phone in modern time, of course, we see that many, many contracts are, even marriage contracts are,
yes,
are you know, are signed. Even we cannot use the term sign, of course, because you cannot sign it from a distance. But contracts are concluded.
Yeah.
Concluded.
Right.
And contracts are finalized on phone. The agreement is reached on phone. Of course, there is no problem to such contracts. They are valid and they are binding.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. And how about those transactions? You know, if one of the parties to the contract lies in it.
Lying is absolutely forbidden. It's an act of deception. It is a kind of fraud exercised by one of the parties. Of course, the transaction is valid. Well, even if one of the parties lies, but the other person who has been deceived has the option, and we use the term khiyar. He has the option to cancel the contract, or even get paid for the loss he has suffered. You know, the other party has the choice to either cancel it or get paid for the money or the loss he has suffered, of course.
Okay. And someone says, Sheikh Javid, you know, what is the ruling on taking a sum of money in exchange for artificially inseminating horses? He says the male horse is mine and the female horse belongs to another person who's asking for the insemination.
Well, there is no problem because it's absolutely permissible to help two horses actually procreate and to get the semen from one of the from the male horse and the eggs from the another, and then they artificially inseminate the horses. And of course, sometimes there's a need for this, and the person who does this job and who is an expert in the artificial insemination is allowed to get paid for it, and the money that he receives is absolutely halal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice comments and answers. And my dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the team here on English Radio, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.